Hello and welcome to Unfrozen episode 119, Mussolini's Ballroom. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik, and we are more than pleased to have as our guest today, Paul Goldberger, who the Huffington Post has called the leading figure in architecture criticism, who is now a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. From 1997 through 2011, he served as the architecture critic for The New Yorker, where he wrote the magazine's celebrated Skyline column. He also holds the Joseph Urban Chair in Design and Architecture at the New School in New York City. He was formerly the Dean of the Parsons School of Design, a division of the New School, and he began his career at the New York Times, where in 1984, his architecture criticism was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Distinguished Criticism, the highest award in journalism. Paul, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So we are here to talk about a recent, a number of things, but let's start with a recent article that you did for the New York Times about the, shall we say, expansionist ambitions that the President Donald J. Trump has for Washington, D.C., starting with the recent, remodeling of the East Wing of the White House. What inspired you to write this piece? And can you tell us the title of this piece and the central comparison that you're drawing there?
Okay. The piece actually in different iterations had a couple of different titles, all of them done by the editors, not me, although I liked them all, actually. At one point, I think it was Mussolini would have loved Trump's ballroom. And another one was Trump will destroy Washington if it's the last thing he does. I can't take creative responsibility for either of those, but I like them both, so I'm fine with them. The only word I'd take issue with here was your discussion of the ballroom as a remodeling, because it's a little more than a remodeling.
I was being a little facetious, but
you were being right. Exactly. Yeah. No. He destroyed the historic East Wing and did it without even a final plan for replacing it, and then produced this humongous ballroom that is really more like a convention center than a ballroom that would overwhelm the rest of the White House. So it really is a very, very hard thing to justify. I mean, the argument that we desperately need this is a pretty empty one. We've gotten by pretty well without it. And in fact, if a president really wants to have a dinner with 1,000 people or more and does not want to do it in a tent outside on the White House grounds, there's some other places in Washington, including, you know, the National Building Museum, the old pension building, has an amazing hall that can seat 1,000 people. And it's actually grander and better as a work of architecture than this ballroom is going to be. There's the Mellon Auditorium, closer to the White House even, that's enormous and quite elegant, that a lot of very, very important events have been in over the years. There's other options. You don't need to build something as enormous, as extravagant, and as really destructive of the White House. I mean, the idea that the White House is going to start looking like a small appendage onto this ballroom is, I think, pretty crazy and outrageous, actually.
But of course, it's not really about the ballroom, is it, Paul? I mean, can you talk a bit about also the larger plans? And of course, in your op-ed, you very eloquently draw a thread, of course, from the president's ambitions for greater Washington, which include, I think Bloomberg has dubbed it Fedlandia, some of the semi-utilized buildings and massive reconstruction plans. Also the president's ambitions on the municipal golf course that he apparently wants to
prioritize. Well, he wants to take over the municipal golf course and redo it, which probably will raise the prices considerably as well and make it not the public park in effect that it is now. He also wants to put along the Potomac, I gather, this thing he's called the Garden of American Heroes, which is a statuary park of people he thinks deserve having statues. I have a feeling it's going to look more like an outdoor version of Madame Tussauds Wax Museum or something. I mean, there's a certain feeling of just clutter with all of this stuff. He thinks it's grander. But it's not. It's just clutter. And just the way the Oval Office in the White House doesn't look grander. It looks just what my old grandmother would have called ungepachket, you know, sort of just all like filled up and messed up and cluttered with crap that somebody mistakenly thinks is elegant.
And the clutter grows by the day. It's interesting that a statue of Christopher Columbus, a replica of it that was torn down in Baltimore during George Floyd's uprising in 2020, has reappeared on the White House grounds, or they put it there
yes,
as well.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the stuff just keeps popping up. I mean, since that piece was written, another thing that I did not include because it hadn't happened yet was the idea that has been floated now to change the columns on the north portico of the White House from Ionic columns to Corinthian, because Corinthian columns are more ornate, and it was thought that these might be more Trumpian in taste.
Interesting. Well, aesthetics aside, or we can come back to it, I would love to elaborate your argument in the op-ed where you draw a line, as I was mentioning, from Trump to Mussolini's plans for Rome. I was to say I would invoke Godwin's law if I were to invoke Albert Speer right here. But it is interesting that these plans periodically appear to do grand remakings of capitals. And you chose Mussolini. I'm curious what inspired you.
I chose Mussolini because I think it's the more apt comparison. A lot of people have talked about Albert Speer in Berlin. So I wanted to say something that hadn't been said before. But Speer was an architect who was basically doing Hitler's bidding. And Mussolini was much more a Trumpian figure. He was, you know, the head of state, not an architect, but he believed he knew more than architects. And he also had this idea that Rome was insufficiently grand. Rome was not worthy of him. And he wanted to remake 20th century Rome so it would have more resemblance to the Rome of the Roman emperors. He wanted to really suggest a direct connection between his Rome, which he called the Third Rome, and the ancient Rome of the Roman Empire. And the implication being that the grandeur of the Roman Empire had faded, but it would come back under Mussolini. Well, you know, Trump's fantasies for Washington seem to be pretty much in the same direction, actually, that this place is a little too modest for his ambitions. And we've got to kind of give it more grandeur, give it more, you know, make it more Trumpian, make it more whatever. And he misses something absolutely critical in American history, which was that Washington was not supposed to be the seat of an empire. It was the seat of a democracy. Very, very different. And in fact, it was intentionally done. I mean, it was carefully planned, but it was not supposed to dazzle you with super ornate, enormous, glittery things. This was not a monarchy. It was not a dictatorship. It was not an autocracy. It was a democracy, and a democracy expresses itself very differently, or at least it was supposed to, or at least it did until now. And so that's really the key thing. I mean, if you look at things that, like Benjamin Latrobe, who was probably the first really important American architect who did not design the White House, but did design a great deal of the Capitol, and was a kind of guiding figure in the early years of and in fact worked with Jefferson a certain amount, Thomas Jefferson, who in fact did design buildings himself. Latrobe talked about simplicity and dignity as being very much in the American grain and of wanting to establish an American architecture in Washington that would, you know, acknowledge the past, would learn from the past, would take elements from the past, but would be different in that there would be something about it that would be simpler, more understated, more modest than the monarchies that America was created to get away from. But, you know, it seems as if Trump is dazzled by all of that, and he is trying, in fact, to push us back to the very kind of architecture that we were created to get away from.
I mean, there's no question what, you know, Trump's tastes are, if you can even call them that.
Right, right.
I think
we've seen it for a long time. It's not
new. Yeah. Right. We saw this coming. But I think what's interesting to us as observers of the architectural community is how he's found so many different collaborators who are willing to do this work. What's the story there?
I
was going to say, the New York Times ran a piece literally yesterday, apparently, with Shalom Baranes. I don't know
Baranes,
if that's his last
Baranes,
name. Baranes, Shalom Baranes is unrepentant about his work on this project.
It was a very well-done profile of him by Elizabeth Bumiller, who's one of their best writers. And it was very well done. He is absolutely unrepentant. He's found collaborators in the world of architecture in the same way that he's found collaborators in the world of politics. People whose ambition gets the better of their judgment. Or maybe they never had that much judgment. Maybe they had only ambition. I don't know. But it's the exact equivalent. You can always find people who will sell their soul. I mean, you know, that history has shown that it's always been possible to find. When the devil comes calling, there's always somebody willing to make a bargain. But I think there are relatively few people in the world of architecture who are. We just got the news that the American Institute of Architects has joined a suit that the National Trust for Historic Preservation has initiated, and several other organizations concerned with the built environment are joining as well to challenge the plans to redo the Kennedy Center. So there is beginning, and the National Trust has filed a very important suit about the White House East Wing ballroom. So, you know, there is some pushing back. It's not correct to say that the whole architecture profession has gone like sheep in this direction. Remember, there's also some people, and the original architect of the White House ballroom was in this category, who are kind of very serious, very traditional classicists who really believe that classicism is this sort of noble, pure way to make architecture, and that modern architecture was a bad idea and we should be going back to tradition. And they do it in the sort of responsible way. They're not the mainstream, but you know, there's something I respect the integrity of that position, even though I don't share it. And James McCreary, who was the first architect of the ballroom, was in that category, and that he ultimately left the project because it was clear that that Trump did not share his vision. Trump simply wanted bigger, 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 and just kept pushing him to something grander and bigger. He didn't care about or understand proportions. He didn't care about scale. He really just wanted something that looked like a convention center, but had a bunch of classical architectural details around the end of it, you know, decorating it. So,
although, to play devil's advocate there, I mean, Is that an unethical position as well? I mean, that sort of falls into the category of the leopard ate my face. You know, he thought the president would enable his own traditionalist agenda.
And he found, you know, he withdrew before the leopard had completely eaten his face. You know, his ethics are kind of beside the larger point. I don't consider him a hero. I just consider him a guy who was smart enough to see that the leopard was heading for his face very quickly, and to sort of, and he, so he stepped back. It is what it is.
Well, expanding the aperture a bit, and talking about enablers, let's expand the aperture a bit to Northern Virginia and to New York. Because it is interesting with Mayor, for example, Mayor Mamdani of New York has proven to be very adept as sort of a Trump whisperer, having made multiple trips to the White House, people expecting a confrontation. Instead, he shows up with mock newspapers saying, "Trump, let's build." And he is attempting to wheedle out, I guess, federal subsidies for, you know, housing at Sunnyside Yards. But I want to pivot to, there's been proposals for both Dulles International Airport. I'll let Dan unpack the exact ones. That would involve renaming it Donald J. Trump International Airport. There's an actual congressional bill. And there's been discussion about renaming Penn Station in New York Donald J. Trump Penn Station in exchange for the Gateway funds, billions of dollars to rebuild the Hudson tunnels. Dan, I don't know if you want to unpack the proposals, but it seems like others are willing to dance with the devil as well.
Well, certainly the proposals have been out there, yes. We don't know yet who is going to dance with the devil. What we know is that the devil has started to play the music. whether people are going to dance or not remains unclear, particularly with Penn Station, which is a project of, you know, with a pretty long timeline. And it is hoped that the new Penn Station will be started by 2027. We're not sure, though. We'll know more this spring as the process kind of works its way forward. In a way, the most egregious of these renamings is, besides the Kennedy Center, which he just decreed, is the proposal to rename the Palm Beach International Airport, the Donald Trump International Airport.
If I recall correctly, there is no airport that's ever been renamed after a living president. That would be.
I think that's as well. Quite correct. I think National Airport was not renamed for Reagan until after his death, I believe. Certainly after his presidency. That's for sure. The thing that is far more egregious about Palm Beach, and that's something that could happen tomorrow if they finalize it, because that airport is, it's not a new airport being constructed, it's there. It would just be a name change, is that, and I found this the most disturbing aspect of all, is that around the time this was being discussed, the Trump Organization trademarked the name Donald Trump International Airport, so that if the name change is in fact put into effect, he will charge a licensing fee for the rights to his name. So that simultaneously he is demanding, like a dictator, that things be named for him, and he is charging money for it, or plans to charge money for the rights to use his name. As if they had begged him for it, and he reluctantly agreed, but only if you give me some money, I'll reluctantly agree. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The entire thing is a scheme to make money. So it's not even about the honor, empty as that honor might be, given that it's sort of an honor that's demanded rather than conferred. But, you know, we're dealing with somebody who unfortunately thinks that, you know, prizes are things you demand and are not simply given to you. That he's demanded a Nobel Peace Prize, which is generally not how these things work.
Particularly when you demand it from the people who don't award it. But
yes, right. That's also true. Yes, yes.
But going back to Dulles, I'm curious your thoughts on those proposals and how it affects Sarin and Turmel. It is interesting, not to defend the president here, but it is interesting that if what I learned when I wrote Aerotropolis is that Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, personally picked the site, and I believe he did name it after, what, the Secretary of State Dulles while he was still alive and in the post? So that is a weird precedent, too.
It's all true. John Foster Dulles. I think the idea was, you know, he was a figure of international, he managed international affairs at a critical time in American history, the post-war era, and Eisenhower wanted to honor him in the nation's capital's international airport. I think it made some sense, even though, you know, Dulles is not the most iconic figure in American history or anything, but nevertheless, whatever. That airport is a long and complex story, as you know, since you're an airport expert. It was a really brilliant and beautiful design by Eero Saarinen, but it also had a lot of flaws in the way, in its concept, because it was built with the kind of cool but ultimately utterly impractical idea of these super weird bus-like vehicles that would take passengers in clumps from the terminal out to the planes that were parked in the field, there were no direct immediate connections. And it was thought somehow that this would be a different and innovative way to do it, but it was all conceived before the age of airport security. And there's just no way it can work in conjunction with the need, you know, with the whole TSA security system, which is, as we know now, you know, problematic enough to keep it working when you have the space for it. But you had no space for it in that airport. So things had to be redone. And what's been done is a whole bunch of different jerry-built arrangements, none of which are very pleasing or very good. I think, in a way, the other great Saarinen airport of that period is the TWA terminal at JFK. In a sort of strange way, that's had a better outcome because that building has been preserved, but not as an airline terminal because it was just too small. There was no way to do security again without destroying the architecture and so forth. And so it's been made the centerpiece of this new TWA hotel, which everybody loves. It's just been a great success. It's one of the most people go there just for fun when they're at the airport. They spend a night there if they didn't have to even. I mean, it's all good. And it's given that building a wonderful new lease on life. Probably some similar things should have been done at Dulles, but you know, that airport's also a lot bigger and it's been expanded already. And so it's a very complicated, difficult problem. I will say that naming it after Trump does not fix the complicated architectural challenges it presents, however.
I mean, for me, that was the one thing where I saw that be, when I saw that announced, I was like, okay, if the Saarinen building is under threat, that is something I will go and chain myself to.
Good. You know, great. Good for you. I'll join you. I'll join you. Because, I mean, the Saarinen building is a great building. It's a great building. And it's so, you know, when you think of that, it symbolized the nation's capital hiring one of the greatest architects of the era to do a building that would be all about the future. And we're not doing stuff like that now at all. I mean, we're going back into a sort of confused and distorted idea of the past. I mean, we haven't even talked about the arch that's proposed for, you know, the Virginia side of the Potomac, just opposite the Lincoln Memorial, which would be a knockoff of the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, but bigger even, because that's not big enough. Napoleon was not grand enough, so it's got to be bigger still, would interfere with the view of Washington from Virginia as you approach, with the view of the Lincoln Memorial, all that. I mean, there's a reason that that area has never had a monument. It's because it's about the open view, not about, again, this the word we talked about early in our conversation, clutter. You know, I mean, it just wants to clutter it up with all this glitzy crap. And
so, Well, I want to go back to some of the proposals that have come forth for Dulles in text and rendering. So the only renderings come forth from Zaha Hadid Architects, which I think given the politics of Patrick Schumacher currently running the firm, I think we could see him potentially aligned with the president. We have proposals reportedly from Ajayi Associates, which is a firm that is half canceled. David's principal, David Ajayi, is under fire for sexual harassment and assault of staffers, but sort of under fire there. And then one of the other proposals is from AECOM, which we've covered in past episodes as their legacy of like really the architects of empire. And given some of the firms that are involved here who are really willing to rush towards the president and rush towards this, I guess I want to ask Paul, like, not to ask you to be the arbiter of the profession, but like, is the only principled stance on this to simply not engage with it? Because this is the United States federal government, and this is public works that will last generations. I mean, should more, you know, can you make a positive difference as we saw at the beginning of the East Ballroom, or is withdrawal the only ethical stance?
I think you can, and I would certainly not tell any architect not to engage. I would say, let's see what the terms are. I mean, Dulles Airport is a long-term project, whatever it's called, whether it stays Dulles or becomes something else. I think it's clear that Donald Trump will not be president when it's finished. It's important to be willing to, in fact, invest in the future. Architecture is about investing in the future. That's kind of what it is. And so, no, I don't think it's wrong. I think it's wrong. There's a real difference between something that is nothing but a vanity project, and we certainly see that there are those in this administration, and something that also has the potential to be a civic good, to be a positive. I mean, we need an international airport in Washington. The current one is in need of a lot of architectural assistance, let's say. And so I think it's a great opportunity for an architect, especially if the administration can bring itself to not turn it into a monument to Trump and his taste. But can, you know, I mean, look, I was in India earlier this winter and visited the ongoing site of the expansion and restoration of the American Embassy in India, which is, interestingly, it's done by Edward Durrell Stone, who did the Kennedy Center. It's one of his most famous and admired buildings. It was not adequate any longer to the needs of the embassy, which have grown. A really good architecture firm, Weissman Freddy from New York, won the commission to expand it and restore the original and expand basically the campus. And they're doing a fantastic job. Now, that project began before this administration. It will continue after this administration. They are just simply, you know, quietly going about their work, which is excellent, and which will represent this country in a wonderful way to the world, I think. And, you know, there are other projects like that. I don't think it's a mistake for any architect to become involved in a project that has real civic value for everyone and is not just a Trumpian vanity project. And hopefully they can do it in a way that, you know, keeps their integrity and the integrity of whatever architecture they are producing. Again, as I said, you know, I think these things have a long timeline, for better or for worse. You don't do major public works quickly. Nobody ever has. It's just not possible.
So maybe now we should go to the urban jungle, since we're talking about leopards eating our faces, and go to Gotham and talk about all the dozens, I think, of proposals for remaking Penn Station over the years, many of which precede the first Trump administration. Everyone knows Penn Station is a disaster. You know, it's, no one loves it. It seems like there's so many immovable objects, including Madison Square Garden sitting right over it. I'm interested in your thoughts about the nexus of A, the desire to return it to its former glory, which of course was a Beaux-Arts classical design, combined with the, you know, the logistical issues of course, the railroading underneath it, and then of course the fact that Madison Square Garden is sitting on top of it, and the owner is, I don't know if he's exactly a Trump advocate, but he's definitely Trumpian in his own ways, Mr. Dolan. So that's interesting. Does that mean something's actually going to get done? And is it going to be a disaster for the ages? Or is it going to be good? You know?
Okay. No, that's a great question. I think actually on Penn Station, we have a real shot at things working out not only well, but better than they might have. I mean, this might be the one case in which Trump's involvement has at least the potential of being positive. And I'm not talking about naming or things like that, or about outrageous and even blackmailing deals that exchange funds for the Gateway Tunnels for naming, but simply the station itself. You know, it's been talked about for years. Everybody knows what a disaster Penn Station was. The destruction of the original Penn Station is sort of the the great tragedy in the history of historic preservation, not only in New York, but maybe in the country. And you will not find anybody who says that that was a good idea, but nevertheless, it happened now 63 years ago. Pat Moynihan, who was probably the last public official in this country to have had a true, deep understanding of architecture and a real knowledge about it and passion for it, proposed that the classically designed post office across the street, also done by McKimmead and White, who did the station, and sitting over the railroad tracks, become a new Penn Station. It was a brilliant idea, and it ultimately, although it took 20 years, did happen, and is now called Moynihan Train Hall. The problem that either nobody understood or wanted to admit back then is that the particular logistics only allowed it to handle a small amount of the train traffic. So most of the traffic is still in the old, rundown, horrible subway-like Penn Station. And so Moynihan, great as it is, and I think it's a great success, it nevertheless was only a little drop in the bucket in terms of fixing the problem. So the state played around with it for a long time, couldn't quite get its act together and get something going, had all these schemes, some of them involved tearing down a bunch of things to build big office towers that nobody really wanted, that were theoretically going to pay for the redo of the station. But anyway, it was not going anywhere. And I will give him credit where it's due. Trump did step in and say the federal government is going to take over this project. Amtrak is technically the owner of the station. And Amtrak is, a federally supported private train corporation. So it did make some sense. And I think it's actually moving forward on a better track, no pun intended. And right now there's a very good version out there that I hope will officially be designated, which calls for keeping Madison Square Garden. Not because it's the ideal, but because the owner of Madison Square Garden is obstinate, you are quite right, and a little too Trumpian, and it would take years and years and years. You couldn't move Madison Square Garden, even if they wanted to, till you built a new one. And he's rejected every proposal for a new one elsewhere. So if you assume that the only way to do this in our lifetimes is to leave it there, this new plan that is now circulating and is under consideration by the federal government leaves Madison Square Garden, but it takes away. There was a huge theater, not an arena, but an actual theater that was originally called the Felt Forum, and then I think it's now called the Hulu Theater, that's under it. And it's not even that well used. If you scooped that out and then built some structural columns to support Penn Station over it, to support the garden staying where it is over it, you actually have enough room for a pretty grand train station. And with a huge formal kind of portico and colonnade on 8th Avenue facing the post office, the Moynihan Station one, and you can actually make it all work. I have seen the plans. I think they're really good. I think that it has the potential to actually be the ideal compromise version, and could really start happening on a pretty quick timeline. So I hope it does happen. It's the best hope we have. There are some alternate plans that call for, again, removing the garden. That's ideal in an ideal world, but I mean, it's going to be 10 more years before the first piece of the station even gets started if you move the garden first. Whereas you can scoop out that empty theater fast and keep the garden operating and build a whole station underneath and have enough room to still have a fill it with natural light, you know, have a real place. So I think that's what I hope will happen.
So this is interesting because, you know, Donald Trump, of course, is a New York native.
Right.
And he's never had a great relationship with the city.
That puts it mildly. Yes.
With its elites, with the general population,
right.
The construction industry, you know, his long list of unpaid bills, et cetera, et cetera. So could this be the thing that finally turns that relationship around? If Penn Station, the redo, is successful, and I mean, it is a fair argument that, you know, you have a stadium concentrated on infrastructure that serves it, you should keep it there. And it could work.
Yeah. I think I'm not going to say, I mean, I support this project. I'm not sure I'm going to say it would, even if it goes forward and comes out well, that it would change Donald Trump's relationship to the city of New York. I mean, there's a few other things that disturb a lot of other voters in New York that are not likely to go away or change. So let's put that aside for a moment. But I tend to put this more in the category of, you know, a stopped clock is right twice a day. I mean, you know, that every single thing he does is not necessarily wrong, even if most of the things he does are wrong. This might be the one place in which the stars align in a funny way, so it makes sense and actually supports the public realm, doesn't diminish it.
All right. Well, speaking of stadia, this is a perfect transition, Paul. Your last book was Ballpark, Baseball in the American City. And to bring it again back to the president, he doesn't seem to have any particularly great affinity for baseball, but he has been very canny or uncanny in his use of sport, including, for example, appeared at multiple football games, politicized Bad Bunny's performance at the Super Bowl, weighed in on this in the culture wars. And with the World Cup coming, the president has cultivated this relationship with Gianni Infantino, the president of FIFA, to the point where he received this Peace Prize, where FIFA is the first.
Yes, the much coveted Peace Prize. Everyone has been talking for years about who was going
to
get it.
First org to sign with the Board of Peace is FIFA. But Paul, it ties into this because, you know, there's two schools of thought on this. One is sort of the bleak jokes made about, you know, whatever few international fans are allowed or willing to enter the United States will arrive at places like Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Arrowhead in Kansas City, and find these stadiums in seas of parking lots rather than well-connected stadia like Camp Nou or San Siro in Europe kind of thing. I'm curious your thoughts about the president's relationship to sport and your thoughts on the architecture of football. I have a whole theory that the dominant sport of its time sort of relates to its media environment. And so baseball was perfectly suited to radio and newspapers. And Chuck Klosterman, the cultural critic, has argued that football is the perfect sport for, you know, our stop and start, distracted attention era age, et cetera there. But I guess I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the president and how he's used the NFL and used the gigantic stages of football to project himself into this too? And what can we expect from the World Cup?
I think it's a great question, Greg. I think he's used football very skillfully. I mean, football is a sport of television first. I mean, you know, football got big when television got big. They kind of rode up to maturity together in a way, you know. I mean, and you're absolutely right. Baseball, you know, baseball moves slowly. It's more modest. It's easier. It's more leisurely. It is the only team sport that is not played against a clock. You know, there's a lot about it that is, you know, almost, I think, quite beautiful in a way, but utterly disconnected from the way Trump views the world. Football is more aggressive. It's faster. It exists for television in a certain way. I mean, and I think Trump understands all of that. I mean, he has an innate understanding of media. He has manipulated it more skillfully than anybody in our time, really. I mean, he is a creation of media, really. And he's certainly not a creation of intellectual ideas or any kind of philosophy. He's a creation of media. And football, while football is not itself a creation of media, its role in our culture kind of is. And so it makes perfect sense. And you know, look, I'm fascinated by how the environments in which sports are played do, in a way, tell you so much about them and about the culture. You know, baseball came out of neighborhoods, was intimately connected to the city, but also to a vision of kind of the rural in the city. And the countryside in the city, and giving it a, football is all about something else, and football, you know, and the latest generation of football stadiums are really, you know, these, you know, enormous enclosed flying saucers kind of where there is very little connection to the outside world. I mean, SoFi in LA or AT&T in Dallas, you know, places like that. I mean, they're fascinating, and I've been thinking about maybe doing a book on those at some point, too, because it's a very different story from the ballpark story, but it's one that tells you as much about our culture, really, and where we are right now. And but you made a reference a moment ago to, you know, these places that are sitting with corporate names inside acres and acres of parking and so forth, and that's the, for me, the biggest issue of all, because one of the things I've loved about baseball parks is how they started doing that in the 50s and then they and 60s, then they broke away and said, no, this is not good. And they started coming back to the city, Camden Yards in Baltimore being the, you know, the one that turned the whole model around. And then everyone else wanted to do the same thing pretty much. What we're waiting for is, you know, what is the new prototype, the archetype of football? And is there a way that it can integrate into a city as easily? I don't know that there is, because, you know, a football stadium is much bigger. It's used much less.
I suppose so, Paul. That's where I totally disagree. My children are actually in love with European club football. So I took them to Milan for Champions League, and San Siro seats 70,000 people, and it's all delivered by transport networks. Maybe in the States, you're right. But it is interesting how Europe has demonstrated that you even can do 90,000 people.
Well, you're right. And in fact, actually, I think, you know, if I do go ahead and write this book, it has to deal with Europe, because Europe actually is a better model. You know, in this country, the culture of, not only the culture of the automobile, the culture of the, you know, tailgating and eating in the parking lot and that whole thing is such a part of the full football experience, too, that I don't know if people are willing to give that up. We'll see. I mean, I you know, we almost had a chance to see it when there was that period when the New York Jets were playing around with doing the stadium on the west side of Manhattan in the what became Hudson Yards. Ultimately, it didn't happen. We don't know whether it would have worked or not. It would have been an attempt to bring the European model here. And anyway, actually, it's funny. The more we're talking about this, the more interested I'm getting in it, because in a way, the story is the story of the war between these two models. And there's some amazing, amazing football stadiums in Europe, too. And they're fantastic, a lot of them.
So is there a new book in the works?
Well, there's a couple of new books. There's one that's almost finished. It's not about sports, actually. It's a book about cities that is actually, the full title is The Imperfect City, design, serendipity, and the real life of cities. And the idea of it is that every city is really a combination of planning and accident. And sometimes the accidents are disaster, but sometimes they're some of the best things we have in cities. And you can't plan a place down to the last inch. It's just not going to work. But laissez-faire is not going to work either, because that's just chaos. So every place really needs to figure out how does it navigate between these two things and let things happen up to a point. Because sometimes, you know, the spontaneous, ordinary life of the street is sometimes, you see that in Europe constantly, how wonderful it is. And we're historically kind of afraid of that here, but we're getting a little bit better. So anyway, that'll be out this fall. And then I'm thinking about this football book too. Big question is, what are we going to call it, football or soccer? If we
all depends on your foreign rights sales, Paul.
Right, that's right. No, but then don't laugh. That's exactly what.
Let's bring this full circle though to end, because it's great that the imperfect city. That's been a subject we've had recently on Frozen with Matthias Echinove and Rahul Srivastava in their book Homegrown Cities. But Paul, in a way, then, and I can see where you drew upon the inspiration in your recent op-ed there about Rome and its sightlines and the serendipity of how it opens up. Would you, this idea of legibility, right, of whether it's Mussolini or the president or planners, and this hatred of this illegible informality in cities and desire to iron it out of existence. I mean, Haussmann, we can keep going with examples. Is that a tension that's eternal, like the Hamiltonian, Jeffersonian one in the States? Is it a tension that can be resolved?
Yeah, Greg, you know, I think that's a very good point. I think it is probably an eternal tension. But the point of this book is that neither side is completely right. And it's in the tension, maybe, that actually cities really come alive and start working. I mean, you know, a city that is just allowed to happen is usually pretty horrible. But a city that is tries to be totally planned is usually kind of dead in a certain way, and lifeless and forced and strained, and it doesn't make you feel good. And ultimately, I think that it is that tension, what you've called like the Hamiltonian, Jeffersonian tension, maybe it's time to start seeing that not as the problem, but as itself the solution, that actually the way those two things kind of play off against each other and exist in tension with each other is what actually makes cities what they are.
Yes, if we think of the city as a theater, right? Dramatic tension is what draws people in.
Yeah, no, that's, Dan, that's exactly right.
It's what fills the seats.
The city is, in fact, a theater. And in fact, Lewis Mumford said, you know, the city is a great stage upon which the actors take their turns as spectators and the spectators take their turns as actors, in which everybody's role is perpetually churning between spectator and actor.
I am already looking forward to our next conversation on this.
Well, thank you. Well, I'd love to come back when the book comes out and talk more about it. But yes, it'd be great.
Mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Paul Goldberger, thank you so much for spending this time with us on Unfrozen. This has been fantastic.
Thank you. Thanks for a great conversation.
Never thought the leopards would eat my face. No, I never thought the leopards would eat my face. Well, I'm the moral authority, so the rules, they don't apply to me. No, I never thought the leopards would eat my face.
Slow it down now.
I never thought the leopards would eat my face. No, I never thought the leopards would eat my face. Well, I'm the moral authority, so the rules, they don't apply to me. No, I never thought the leopards would eat